powerful is the Cox Network. So powerful that one day, the internet will let your doctor perform miracles from thousands of miles away.
Connecting to remote operating room.
Giving a whole new meaning to the term house call.
Operation complete.
The Cox Network. With gig speeds everywhere, it's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, bringing us closer. In Cox serviceable areas, speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms apply. Other restrictions may apply.
Rising Giants Network.
If the government is still where it is now, we won't have any children in Lebanon because I'm afraid to lose another kid. And I can't go through this again. It's too difficult.
I think the trauma is more mental than physical, regardless of how much damage it made physically. I mean, I still, till this day, remember exactly all the details of what happened on that day. I think I will always remember it for the rest of my life.
If I want to use my own example, I mean, I'm 41 years old, and after this explosion, it was the first time that I'd actually decided to go to a therapist to deal with the impact and the after effect of what had happened during the explosion.
I'm Linda Tamim, and from the Rising Giants Network, this is the Beirut Blast. This podcast doesn't only recall the trauma lived by Beirut residents on August 4, 2020. It's also an opportunity to reflect on the year past, to mourn our loved ones, and to tell our story. And most importantly, never to forget. As a journalist working in Beirut, I was on the ground covering the events from the day of the explosion onwards. I witnessed destruction, trauma, and death. I've met with people who lost loved ones, whose homes were destroyed, and whose hopes and dreams were shattered. I spoke to many who, driven by desperation, were trying the impossible to leave Lebanon, whether by applying for immigration, by looking to work or study abroad, and even by embarking with their families on perilous journeys across the Mediterranean, trying to reach Cyprus illegally. The country has become hell on earth, they say. A jungle, a sinking ship, a place with no peace, a place with no safety or stability, a country with no future. Yet I also came across a few who are still holding on to the little bit of hope they have left in their heart. Hope that Lebanon is worth fighting for. Hope that someday they can finally build a country they will never have to escape. This is the story of August 4, 2020, told by the people of Beirut. People who came together and gave their all when they had nothing left. People abandoned by their governments and left to survive the aftermath of one of the most powerful explosions in the world on their own. People I shared hugs and tears with, people whose strength I admire, whether they chose to leave or remain in the country. It's a story of loss, trauma, and survival. And it's also a call for justice, accountability, and closure. The content of this podcast can be pretty graphic and horrifying. There is no happy ending yet, at least. This podcast isn't for sensitive ears or for children. If it's starting to feel like too much, just switch it off. July 30th, 2021, 7:30 a.m. I was sitting on my balcony with my cup of coffee, lost in my own thoughts. It was a hot summer morning and the air felt heavy. As the sea breeze stroked my face, I gazed at the grain silos, or whatever was left of them. I couldn't help but think that if another blast was to occur, that would really be it for me. And I was chuckling as I remembered my friends calling me crazy for renting a place facing the port yet again. And maybe I was. Earlier that morning, I was cleaning the balcony floor when a shining piece of glass near the drain caught my attention. A shiver went down my spine as I picked it up. Ever since that dreadful August 4th of last year, I could never see pieces of glass for what they were. No matter their size or color, they always revived those memories, those emotions, those scars. For some, the blast also revived old trauma caused by previous wars. Personally, I could never forget the sound of bombs I used to hear during the 2006 war. I haven't been able to deal with loud noises ever since, and today, it's even worse. Of course, I'm not alone. Everyone who's lived this disaster is dealing with their own trauma, their own wounds which may never heal. Dr. George Kerem was telling me about the hundreds of cases he and his team received after the blast.
When you live a trauma like that, what you have at the beginning is what we call acute stress disorder. The large majority of people that lived that blast developed symptoms of acute stress disorder, where you are having nightmares, where you are having flashbacks of the blast, where you are hypervigilant, meaning that every time you hear a door closing or if you hear a plane passing, you would jump right away. So any tiny noise will make you relive the situation. And because of that, a lot of people were coming and seeking help. We had a lot of parents call us on the hotline trying to find out how to help their children. You know, their daughter who is 8 now and she's refusing to go back and sleep in her own bed. She wants to sleep next to her mom or dad. So how to deal with this?
Dana Haddad is a dietitian at St. George Hospital, where Dr. George works. She was in the building when the explosion happened, and like many I spoke to, she heard the sound of planes before the tragedy occurred. A sound which traumatized her and keeps haunting her today.
I think we are equally affected whether we were injured or not. For me, it's just listening to a loud noise. It makes me feel unsafe. Hearing any airplane landing or taking off or just flying over me, the airplanes scare me right now because I heard airplanes the day of the blast. So now this is a major trauma for me, like a major phobia. I can't hear the sound of airplanes right now, whether I'm at the airport or just sitting at home and I hear fighter jets. When I'm with a big group, I feel that I cannot, I'm trying to control my feelings, but it shows, always shows that there's something wrong. And they try to comfort me and say it's fine. But I'm sure it's not fine, like hearing fire jets all the time flying over us. It's going to bring back the trauma, definitely.
Still at St. George Hospital, Stephanie is back at work. Like many of the hospital staff, it had been very difficult for her to return to the building, a place she'll always associate with a nightmare of August 4.
I was definitely very terrified of stepping back into the hospital. And I had tears in my eyes, but the one thing that kept me going was that I kept saying in my head, it's not destroyed, it's being rebuilt. So it's not destruction, it's under construction. That's what I had to keep saying over and over and over again to be able to get back to work. I think the first patient that I delivered back in that delivery room was difficult. But I think doctors are very superstitious people. So I never wore the same scrubs again. The scrub hat I kept and I actually wore because I felt like it protected me because it had a tear in it, but I didn't have a scratch underneath. But the scrubs I never wore again. And whenever the same people would be in the same delivery room at around 6 p.m., we'd make sure the baby was either delivered before or after 10 past 6 because we can't deal with the fact that a baby would be born at 6:08 on a Tuesday with the same team. So there are things like that we still try to avoid. I don't like being on call on the 4th of any month that sets to be a Tuesday. Or I try to be out of the hospital or in a different area in that same place.
As Dr. George was mentioning, many children are also traumatized, especially those who are close enough to the blast scene. Elias was telling me about the cases he encountered.
There's a lot of stories of children that we saw after the explosion that, for example, if they heard any loud noise, would hide under their beds, would hide under the table. We had a child in one session that saw smoke from far away and he started to become hysterical. He started screaming. He started crying. He ran away from the source of the smoke and tried to find a hiding place. There are other children that we worked with as well that lost their ability to speak. They lost their ability to express themselves. Other children became more violent, became more aggressive after they'd gone through this event. And what we tried to do is we tried to work with them in a variety of different You know, we did some drawing competitions, for example. We got them to write stories. And it's just so impactful to see them expressing themselves in these ways, because that's when the trauma really comes out. It feels like these children have been through a lifetime of pain, a lifetime of suffering, of trauma. And what they're expressing shocked us when we were working with these children, just to hear the words that they were using, some of the drawings that they were drawing, the graphic nature of them, the darkness that you felt was present inside these children because of what they'd been through.
While many children were psychologically impacted, others weren't lucky enough to survive. August 7, 2020 was the darkest and most tragic day for Paul and Tracy Najjar. After 3 days of fighting for her life in hospital, their little daughter Alexandra succumbed to her wounds. Their world was shattered, and the entire country mourned one of the youngest victims of the explosion. A year on, Tracy cannot bear being stuck in traffic. She gets panic attacks every time she is reminded of how she and her family were stranded on the way to hospital. In a country like Lebanon, where traffic is part of everyday life, the couple needs to check for clear roads on Google Maps before they head out. But what she dreads the most ever since Alexandra's passing is having other children in Lebanon. Both her and Paul describe their pain.
If the government is still where it is now, we won't have any children in Lebanon, because I'm too, I'm afraid to lose another kid, and I can't go through this again. It's too difficult.
You live with intense pain every day. But it's mental, it's emotional. People talk about, you know, time making it better. I think it's bullshit, because at least it's not the case for us. I think, you know, it's this really big pain that's here all the time. And you live with it. So you start the beginning of the day can be bad, but then it takes a few minutes, an hour, but then you start, you know, going through your day and trying to be as happy as you can, quote unquote, and, you know, keep on living, because they took so much from us. We don't want, Tracy and I don't want, we won't accept that they would take, you know, our life away as well.
Looking at Bashir sitting across from me, I can still see the scar cutting through his face. It sure looks better than it did when I first met him a year ago, but it's still there. And like his scar, his emotional trauma is here to stay. He told me how he's been coping with it.
This trauma is always going to stay. I mean, for example, there's stuff that I don't have control over. So if I hear a loud noise, or if I hear fire cracks, or even if I see windows that have glass on them, or if I'm somewhere near glass, I just tend to stay away. And whenever I hear a loud noise, or you know, something that resembles to a fire crack, or something that just it gives me chills, because I automatically it triggers that that memory. I try to look in different things that will help me heal from this trauma, and just try to tame down the trauma. So in order to do that, I go more into music. I go more into playing drums. I go more into doing what I do as a person. I'm a musician. I'm a drummer. So drums is like a kind of meditation for me. And it's kind of something that takes my mind off everything, literally.
Drums weren't only therapeutic for Bashir. Elias and his team had to find creative ways to address children's trauma, and ironically, they found that drumming helped many children cope with loud sounds.
So what we did is we tried to use music as one example to get them to feel more comfortable with different types of sounds, and to turn them from a negative to a positive. So for example, the sound of a drum, which in itself, if you hear it and you're not paying attention to it, comes across as very loud. and could be very a very scary experience for a child. And what we tried to do is we tried to get them to do, for example, a drum circle, something that's done in Indigenous communities in Canada, for example. And in that drum circle, what they end up doing is you see them at first hesitant. They beat that drum in a way that's very sort of soft, and they're a bit afraid, they're a bit apprehensive. And by the end of the exercise, you see that they're just trashing away at this drum. You know, they're letting it all out. And they're also screaming, and they're also okay with the noise. They're okay with the loudness of it, with the frequency of it. And we found that when they go through that type of experience, aside from just venting all of these emotions out, a drum circle also helps them in being okay with that volume again. And we saw a lot of positive responses.
Music and art are therapy for the soul indeed. Personally, I bought a mandala coloring book and would spend hours coloring with my favorite tunes playing in the background. It was a form of meditation for me, a great way to escape. But of course, there are different ways to cope with pain. 4 months after the blast around Christmas time, Paul and Tracy wanted to escape Lebanon for the holidays. The thought of spending Christmas without Alexandra was too painful. But as they were chatting with Basecamp volunteers, they had a change of heart.
I took part, you know, psychologically, the fact that we're going to leave is actually not going to help. So it's going to help us, you know, just on the 24th, but running away will hit back when we come back. So let's not run away. Let's not spend Christmas. Let's help people spend Christmas this year. And then we started, you know, thinking about something that will make people happy. And both, so people in need and actually the victims of the blast or the families of the victims of the blast. From August till December 24th, we didn't go back home. We didn't go back to Jemaisé. So I told Paul, let's do something that will help people that left their houses in Jemaisé like us and can't come back to this house for the first time. You know, from their home, help other people in need. So the idea was for the people of Jemaisé to come back home with friends and family on the 23rd, 24th, and cook from their house to people in need on this Christmas Day. And so that's what happened. So we came back for the first time, Paul and I, on the 24th, with some friends and some family, and we all cooked. We cooked some lasagne for, a lot of people. And Basecamp helped us a lot with that. So Basecamp at this time were based on the ground floor, at the ground floor of our building, actually. And it was really, really good. You know, people were cooking. We cooked with friends. The bad memory or the fear that we had coming back to this house actually, you know, helped us a lot.
Paul and Tracy ended up distributing 6,000 meals to thousands of families that Christmas. And as Tracy said, giving back was a form of therapy. There's definitely something about being of service to others in difficult times that helps you cope with trauma. Dr. George Kadam explained.
You know, it was really overwhelming to be able to help people, overwhelming in a positive way and in a negative way, both at the same time. It was overwhelming in a negative way because we were asking all of our staff members to be offering help and helping others where they lived the trauma themselves, where their offices were destroyed, their cars were destroyed, their loved ones died. So it was really tough on us to be able to help others, and we have to live through our own trauma. At the same time, there is something wonderful that happens in the brain where there is a disconnect that happens, and you, the mere fact of helping others make you feel better. And this is wonderful. And we call that post-traumatic growth. And you see that, in fact, in several instances where people that get affected by a terrible blast or by a trauma, specific trauma, instead of despairing and falling into depression, on the contrary, they jump and they start helping. And you see that in several instances. Like, let's say you have a mother whose son died in a car accident. So instead of just despairing and falling into depression, she would form an NGO in order to train people on how not to drive fast and how to take care of, you know, road safety. And we have several examples like that in Lebanon.
Back at Meirig, Aline reflected on the 3 months she spent cooking meals for people with the many volunteers who had joined her and her staff members, some of them injured at the time. Just like Paul and Tracy's experience, it was therapy for her as well.
It was our major therapeutic work that we've done with our team, because working and cooking for 2,500 people with half wounded and the rest of the team was our only way to feel part of reconstruction, to feel part of helping others, to feel part of giving back, to feel part of this ambience, this team. We don't know anyone. Everybody was coming in to help, coming to help cleaning the restaurant, coming to help cleaning the vegetables to distribute food. Everybody was everywhere. This ambience was our therapy. This ambience was the reason why we are rebuilding, the reason why we are staying, the reason why we are giving back.
One afternoon, a couple of days after the blast, my crew and I were driving through Jaitewi, yet another neighborhood heavily impacted by the explosion. I spotted a young woman walking with a broom in hand. I asked the driver to stop the car and told the cameraman to follow me as I jumped out. I approached the woman, Adelaide her name was, and asked her if I could have a few words with her on camera. She smiled, a bit unsure at first, but she accepted. I asked her where she was headed with that broomstick, to which she responded, "I'm out to help people. It's my duty. I cannot see my city destroyed and sit and do nothing about it." I can't explain why, but her words moved me so deeply. I found myself forgetting all about the camera and the microphone and giving her a big hug as we both burst into tears. I was so thankful for Adelaide and everyone else like her. They gave me a ray of hope, a reason to still believe. I'm still in touch with Adelaide today. In fact, she's the one who introduced me to Eli, one of her fellow volunteers who spoke to me in the previous episode. Eli said being of service to others helped him cope with depression, but he couldn't have possibly done it without his friend's support.
Personally, for me, I've never done something this important to me. It actually, like, it moved me a lot, and throughout everything that was happening, I was becoming depressed. And these small acts of kindness actually made me feel so good, even when I was depressed. And I would go to work and they would ask me, "What's wrong with you? Hey, cheer up, man." You know, at some point throughout everything that was happening, I was like, "I want to quit. I can't do it." But my friends would just push me and just like, go, man, let's do it. And you know, what is beautiful about it is your friends push you, you know? We have this support for each other. We would talk to each other about everything that was happening. Every time we finish, we go back together, we do something, we sit, we talk about everything that happened throughout the day. And this actually made a big difference, because it's like going to therapy or something, you know? We were actually being each other's therapists in a way.
I had never witnessed such a spirit of solidarity among people. It was really overwhelming, and as Aline mentioned, it was probably the only way for us to move forward. Each one of us is coping in the best of our ability, but some of us just couldn't manage to live with what had happened, with the loss, with the trauma. Many couldn't go back to work, to their homes, as was the case for Paul and Tracy, or wherever it is that they were when the blast occurred. Others just could not bear to stay in the country. But a number of those who chose to stay have decided to fight. They want justice and accountability. They want truth. It's their only way to get closure, to mourn their loved ones, and to move forward. To build the Lebanon they've always dreamed of. In the next episode, we'll hear the stories of some who've been fighting on the ground and paving the way for change.
So on the 7th of August, Lexu passed away. We buried her on the 8th and started the fight.
We shouldn't adapt. We shouldn't be resilient. We're not a phoenix. We lost our money. We lost our country. We lost a lot of children and citizens. So it's not something to be resilient about.
I am one of the people who decided to pick a cause and started fighting for it, because I don't want to leave the country and I don't want to go back to a leader that never represented something for me. I don't believe that they have the ability. I don't believe they know how to do it. They just don't know how to be politicians.
Ground pressure is not enough. Ground movement is not enough. Without a proper political vision and reforms and a proper plan and roadmap, we won't be able to change.
Our hearts go out to everyone who's lost their loved ones, their homes, to everyone who was forced to leave their country behind to build a better future for themselves. Thank you for listening to our story. Don't hesitate to share this podcast if it has moved you in any way. We need the world to hear about our fight for justice. Beirut Blast is a Rising Giants Network production. Written and narrated by myself, Linda Tamim. Mixing and sound design by Bashar Najjar and Saad Kiswani. Beirut Blast is available on Apple Podcast, Anghami, Spotify, Deezer, Podio, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe and rate Beirut Blast on your favorite podcast app.
It's intern Gian. Celebrate the coziest season with Safeway. They're bringing all the fall flavors to you. From pumpkin everything to caramel apples and all of your seasonal favorites. Make the most of those fireside dinners, game-winning touchdowns, and warm family gatherings. Visit your neighborhood Safeway today or shop online for easy pickup or delivery. They're here to help you spice, season, and savor every moment. Sincerely, Safeway.